General Government to order. We're opening a public hearing today on Senate Bill 5538. This is the Public Employee Retirement Systems budget. Dallas, do you want to go ahead and begin on your overview?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Public Employees Retirement System has two programs, two budgetary programs, the retirement systems and then the deferred compensation program. Its budget request is roughly $50 million in limitation for administration of the system, our systems, and then $4.2 billion of non-limited for payment of retirement benefits, funds, and health insurance premiums and the like. Its entire budget is other funds from employer and employee contributions, earnings on investments, and the like. There were three budget notes from the 2001 session. One requested the Department of Administrative Services, Human Resources Services Division, and Budget Management Division to review all position classifications and the org structure. The classification review was completed because of budget constraints and demands of special sessions. The entire org structure wasn't reviewed. However, there was some review of the organizational structure done when the Department of Administrative Services did a review of the OPUS project. The audit committee was requested to evaluate administration of the deferred comp program to see if it would be beneficial to have it all contracted out. That report has been issued, and they found no recommendation for substantive changes to the program were made. PERS was directed to reduce travel time and costs through the use of video and teleconferencing for informational and instructional meetings and with employers and members across the state. There was one audit report by the Audits Division issued other than their annual financial audit reports that basically confirmed what was known, that that there were errors in benefit calculations. This was a result of a couple of management letters and discussions with management at PERS. Audits Division conducted this report, this audit, and issued this report. The Department of Administrative Services also conducted a review of the administration of the Oregon Pension Administration System project. This was done with in light of the non-funding of it, that project, to see what happened. The review highlighted some communication with the Information Resource Management Division and some other issues, and now the Department of Administrative Services and Public Employees Retirement System are addressing as the retirement system is moving forward with its development of a replacement or new system. And that one, as we know, is designed to replace the existing retirement information management system. So that sums up the results. There were three budget notes. They'll be addressing them, I'm sure, in their presentation.
All right. Thanks, Dallas. Corey, you want to go ahead?
Sure. You should have a handout in front of you that has the governor's budget in front of it. On page 2, you can see 9901 actuals and 2103 close of session and fifth special session level budgets. The governor's budget is $50.1 million in the other funds limited category, a little over $4.2 billion in the non-limited category, 258 positions, 254 FTE in the governor's recommended budget, and a 16.2% increase from fifth special session level. Moving to the next page, you see that the bulk of the PERS budget is in the non-limited category. The operational budget is just 1.2% of their total budget. Again, as I mentioned, the governor's budget is a 16.2% increase from the fifth special session approved level. Major programs and services included in the governor's budget include a number of initiatives to support improvements to data and calculation accuracy, initiatives to clear current workload backlogs, and to address ongoing workload needs so that we don't get into the backlog situation moving forward, and then to improve agency productivity in a number of areas. There's also a package included, which we'll talk about briefly in a few minutes, to bring standard retirement health insurance account, which has previously been a non-budgeted item, on budget into the non-limited category. Moving to the next page, you'll see just another slice at looking at the programs. If you're looking at pension system versus deferred compensation programs, you can see that the bulk of the funds are in the pension system proper, and that less than a percent, significantly less than a percent, are in the deferred compensation program area. Yet another slice at how to look at PERS budget. The bulk of the budget, again, in the non-limited category, and that's going out in special payments. That really is retiree benefits and all of the dollars that are associated with the trust side. On the operational side, that other 1.18% there, personal services, the largest part, services and supplies, the next largest, and then there's actually some funds for capital outlay and debt service. Just quickly looking at how we put the PERS budget together from a methodology standpoint, the 0103 legislatively adopted budget started with just over $3.6 billion in other funds. There were some actions approved through April of 2002, including emergency board approvals for a number of items. Base budget adjustments included largely roll-up of position actions and compensation changes. I think there was also a slight adjustment to true up debt service costs. And then essential packages, which the agency will go into slightly more detail. Essential packages in whole resulted actually in a reduction of almost $580,000. And that was largely a result of phasing out emergency board approvals that were simply one time. Going into the policy packages, there are a number of policy packages supported by the governor in his budget. The 080 package and 084 packages are simply bringing forward what has been approved by the Legislative Assembly via emergency board approval. That includes $309,100 for Attorney General related costs and $870,858 for six positions related to information technology projects. Package 101, which is entitled CSL Adjustments, isn't necessarily CSL in the technical format. It's probably not a good name, especially in how we're approaching the budget now. But really, this was a number of actions that allow the agency to continue operating at the level that they have been providing services for a number of areas that were actually in a deficit position during the 0103 budget period. Package 102 is really the first pure policy package, and it's Act for Accuracy initiatives. Again, 12 positions and almost $1.3 million in other funds. And I'm just going to go through these quickly because the agency will actually provide some more detail. Package 103, workload backlog clearance, $1.1 million other funds and 11 positions. 104, productivity improvements, just over $439,000 other funds and one position. 105, again, following that same theme, workload and an ongoing capacity. 103 looked at clearing backlogs. This is preventing them from occurring in the future. $465,000 and four positions. You see actually 4.5 full-time equivalent here. That's because we're actually taking one position that had already been established and increasing the FTE on that position. 109 was actually a package that you'll see a technical adjustment for in a minute. That related to a legislative concept that was not brought forward not necessarily last minute, but towards the end of the process. So we need to pull those dollars actually out of the budget. And package 110 is that SREARS non-limited expenditure authority. It's actually bringing $155.8 million of other funds into the non-limited category. Again, these were funds that were have always been going out and coming in and part of PERS operations, but they were non-budgeted. And we felt that it was appropriate to actually bring them on budget so that we can more appropriately track how those funds are going through the system. Looking at the deferred compensation side, just two packages, again following the same theme of accuracy, productivity. Package 202 is productivity improvements, just a small amount of dollars related to productivity in several deferred compensation areas. 203, workload ongoing capacity, again, just over $92,000, and one position to address ongoing workload needs. Again, technical adjustments, package 109, that was the rollover purchase that I spoke about. This legislative concept was not brought forward, so we need to pull the dollars related to that and the positions out of the governor's balanced budget level. And finally, there are a number of other adjustments that PERS has proposed and that the governor's office supports. That budget management would, at the direction of the committee, like to continue working with legislative fiscal. These include a number of things that you've seen for other agencies, including adjustments for the merit and COLA actions. There also are a number of technical adjustments to packages related to position classification and establishment. As we mentioned in previous times that we've been before you, all policy packages that have been brought forward, we actually have pushed through the HRSD review process. And there were a number of those that were still pending review or appeal, if you want to be that formal about it, so to speak, that weren't completely through that process until after the governor's balanced budget was adopted. So these are technical adjustments related to final recommendations coming out of HRSD. There also is a fairly significant adjustment to the beginning balance in Package 110. Again, that's bringing that non-limited category on budget. And a few other minor technical adjustments that the department would like to work with BAM and LFO on. Now, hopping to another category, there are a number of policy and workload-related adjustments that have been proposed. And they're really in two major categories, those that are related to workload needs stemming from the significant increase in the number of retirees, and those that are related to the pension reform that is going on right now. And the piece related to workload, we are definitely in support of and would like to continue working with the committee and LFO on moving the agency towards dealing with that issue. Those pieces related to pension reform, I think, will come through this committee in a different format, and that's attached to the actual bills that are addressing those reforms. So we would support that sort of movement forward with those pieces. And that really is the high-level overview. I can answer any questions.
Thank you, Cora. Are there any questions for Cora? Ms. Parker? Representative Patridge?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to go through the back pieces on the special reports in Section E. I'm on page 1 of 9. It's 2 in, and maybe Jim can add. I had a question in the revenue section. I haven't gotten to the other section.
Okay.
We're just assuming huge interest income on, we're assuming a large interest income jump on other funds. I'm wondering what your assumed interest is going to be for the budget.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, you're looking at page 1 of 9, and I assume you're looking at
line 3200, second one up from the bottom.
Okay. And you're looking at the jump from 2.7 to 4.5.
Well, I'm looking at 4.5 jump to 6.1.
Oh, okay. I was going to explain another. actually, I guess now that I've raised it, there were some reporting discrepancies between the initial adopted budget and estimates, and so that's where you see, you'll notice that the other fund limited and other fund non-limited categories have sort of flopped between the adopted and the estimates column. So that explains what I was actually initially going to respond to. I'll let the agency respond in more detail to the interest assumptions, but I think the largely we're talking about a larger pot of dollars sitting there. I mean, as more and more,
I'm just trying to understand what's imputed in that. I can wait until Jim does his presentation.
Sure.
I can go through these and we can at the end.
Chair Butler, with your permission, I think the answer to this is very, very simple.
Okay.
And that is that this budget is the larger budget number that Cora talked about. That is with all our non-limited.
Right.
And we have to ask ourselves, what is that pot of money going to earn? Our default assumption is always the assumed rate that the actuary recommends and the board accepts. I'm Jim Voitko. I'm the director of the Public Employees Retirement System of Oregon. Thank you for the reminder, Dallas. And we assume 8% in each and every year, even though it is our average assumption for the average for 40 years, but it is always our default assumption. We stand here now in April, and I think if I could anticipate your next question, Representative Patridge, no, we've not earned it yet.
Okay. Why don't we then go ahead with your presentation, Jim, and we'll just take off right from there.
Thank you very much, Chair Butler, members of the committee. I really appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today. I Cora gave an excellent overview, and I'd like to just follow it up and highlight a few things that she said by way of introduction before we get into the trees. Administratively, as her presentation indicated, this will probably be the most challenging 2 years in the agency's 56 or 57-year history. And I think that explains somewhat the anomaly of an agency coming before you in these terribly difficult budget times and showing an increase in FTE and in budget in our recommendations and in the governor's recommended budget, because it is an anomaly, and we realize that we stick out like a sore thumb with respect to our sister agencies. Even though we only use trust fund monies in our budget, and we are completely self-funded in that respect, nonetheless, it still appears to be an anomaly. It's clear, however, that our workload is going up, and in fact it is going up more rapidly than we expected. The complexity of our program is going up. Our litigation activity and future litigation probabilities are going up.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Patridge.
And that, I mean, I just got to the Attorney General line item in the budget as you went. And if you're saying it's up, but you dropped down on how much money you're asking for. So anyway, I just want to make sure we go back to that.
I'd be happy to, and there's an explanation
for that. Keep going, Jim. Sorry.
And just to sum up, the other thing that, and it reflects the bulk of the FTE that we're asking for here, is that we really decided in this budget to set forth clear initiatives to attack two cumulative problems that have been building up really for the last 20 years in the agency. And that is, as Cora referred to them, our backlogs, some of which date back to the early 1990s, transactions that were initiated, estimated, but never finished, and our accuracy. I think Dallas referred to the benefits calculation audit that was done. This was an unusual audit in that the agency actually requested the audits division to double the size of the audit and to focus on a broad spectrum of transaction categories, because we thought that it would be useful for the audits division, but also extremely useful for us. It was. It told us that we have a severe accuracy problem. And we, from a prudency point of view, looked at the backlogs and looked at the accuracy and said it would be imprudent of us not to put forward an initiative to attack both of those, because there's an indication that without an attack, they will continue, if not get worse.
Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I just want to ask a clarifying background question so that I can follow the rest of the presentation as you go forward. Explain a little bit, if you would, Mr. White, about the backlogs. You said they go back to the 90s. A character of the backlogs, a number, what led to the backlogs, and now with as many people coming out of the system as there are, or into the system, depending on how you want to say it, that it just seems to exacerbate the backlog.
Chair Butler, Representative Johnson, that you are exactly right in that conclusion. The backlogs actually, and we've developed a report that we've presented to the board, and we'd be happy to provide it to you, that detail the types of transactions that we have backlogs for. And they range from very serious ones, and I'll give you an example of one of those. A member dies. We get recognition of the death, and we stop payment of the benefit, as is required by law. But then the issue is that we have to determine whether or not there was an extra month of benefit paid that was contrary to law.
And depending on the time of death.
On the time of death, exactly. Statute and rule are fairly specific about this. But this is very time-consuming, because you have to reach out to the person's estate, family, figure out the time of death, when the checks were issued. So we have a backlog of these no-pay investigations, and there may be money owed the trust fund. So that's an example of one where there's financial risk. Another one where there is programmatic risk is that we have literally thousands of return statements, notices, letters that have been generated over the years from members that we've been trying to contact for a variety of reasons, or send information, or complete transactions that we have not been able to complete and follow through on. And there's any number of types of transactions in between. A member, for example, says, I worked at the Portland School District for two more years than their records show. We are obligated by law to settle that dispute between the employer and the employee so that they get whatever benefit is that is required to pay them by law. We have a backlog, a very substantial one, of those types of investigations and resolution. So those are some examples. Why do they come about, which was your other question? Typically because the press of business for current transactions, somebody has left their job, stopped their income, and we need to get them a retirement income started as is required by law. That takes a higher priority, and it takes a higher priority because you've told us to in statute. We have a statutory deadline of 92 days, I believe. So that we continually push these other backlog transactions or incompleted transactions aside to hit statutory priorities. And then the other reason is that programmatic change, the double lump sum, the actuarial equivalency factors, Tier 2 during the 90s, all of these things came in and took priority over completing these transactions. It's not a good situation. It's not a healthy programmatic situation. And what we've tried to do, though, if you notice in the presentation that Cora gave, is to try to package these things as one biennia initiatives to accomplish as much as we can, almost exclusively with limited duration personnel. And we'll assess where we are at the end of that 2 years if the committee and the legislature is supportive of these initiatives. And we hope to improve the status of the agency substantially over what has happened over the last 20 years.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson?
Give me a sense of the scope or the universe, both in dollars and in actual cases. Are they thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands?
Chair Butler, Representative Johnson, I can't give you a dollar amount. That's one of the problems, is that until you resolve them, you don't know how much is at stake. But I can tell you that it's thousands of various types of transactions, ranging from the mundane to the more important.
One last one.
Follow up.
At this point in time, are any of these generating litigation?
Chair Butler, Representative Johnson, yes, some of them are in the form of contested cases, but I can't say that these at the moment are the main source of our litigation. The main source of our litigation are challenges by various stakeholders about our program structure. These are typically involving a single employee or a single employer, as opposed to each one involves at most one employer and one employee, as opposed to something that applies to many employers or many employees. Those are the kinds of things that we're getting sued over.
Thank you.
Chair recognizes Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, some of your staff the other day came to me and talked to me about some of those backlogs, and their numbers were pretty clear that there were actually significant backlogs in a number of different areas. But in regards to the audit that was done, I'm looking at a summary here from the Secretary of State's office, actually, of their audit. And they were auditing benefit calculations, both overpayment and underpayments, and those could balance each other out, actually. But they placed the cost savings or recoveries or question cost at $74,000, which is $74,000 is a significant number in some ways, but in comparison to all of your payouts, $74,000 is practically a rounding error. Is there just evidence that there are, you know, errors in most of those or a high percentage of those calculations? And actually, the errors could be, if you had some threshold in the sense of determining what the error was, might get a better picture than probably just errors, because errors might be dominant if you're going to take it all the way down to the decimal point. But are they significant errors in members' benefit calculations? Or
Chair Butler, Senator Devlin, that's an excellent question, and if I could respond in the following way. The audit staff and our internal audit staff, when management raised exactly the same point that you raised, responded by saying, yes, but the statute requires you to pay the right benefit to every individual, not the right benefit average overall. so that our contract, if you will, our obligation is literally person by person. The second thing that they raised, and by the way, I agreed with that because that is what the law says. The second thing is that that same report, the benefits audit, says that these may not be material to the fund, but they may very well be material to the individual. And the third thing is that when you look at the health of a transaction program as large as ours, which may be the largest in the state, it is extraordinarily unhealthy sign to see an error rate, a financial error rate of 15% and a total error rate, including documentation errors, of over 30%. It's kind of like a patient who's come into a doctor's office and he's got a fever and he's blotchy and he's shaking and his heartbeat is not good. He may still be walking, but it's not a good sign. I've worked in the private sector for financial organizations for almost all my life, and our target error rate was less than 1%. So we're far off the mark from what would be a healthy organization, particularly one responsible for billions of dollars. So I agree with your characterization of the materiality to the fund as a whole, but it's not terribly comforting to me.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
In terms of reducing that rate, is it a matter, I would assume it is, not only of your internal activities within the agency, but you interact with a multitude of public agencies, and the accuracy of their records probably determines also the accuracy of your calculations.
Chair Butler, Senator Devlin, absolutely, and indeed it is one of the largest sources of error. In our reconciliation annually with many employers, we find data reporting errors of as high as 40%. And that's one of the reasons why that process takes over 3 months to do back and forth. Part of it is employer difficulties, turnover on their part. Part of it is our program complexity is not easy. So when you look at the accuracy initiative, if I may, what you see is that it's a multi-pronged attack. There are a couple of people that we hope to assign directly to improving the employers at the source, the employers reporting. The second level is at the intake level, where the employee often makes mistakes in reporting data to us about their intended transaction. What we're trying to, with these limited duration people, we want to build an intake team that tries to clean the application for a transaction before it gets to our transaction staff. And then the third thing we want to do is we want to give the ability of greater supervisory review by taking some of our supervisors and let them do more supervision and review of these manual transactions, as opposed to now they do some supervisory review and they're actually player coaches. They do their own, they have their own transaction responsibilities. That's the short run. The long run, this can be done in automated fashion. This is how it's typically done, but we can't do it this biennium. It would take too long, and that's one of the reasons why we're asking for a limited duration effort to bridge us until we can improve our automated ability to scan transactions and spot errors before they get booked.
Representative Patrick, you recognize?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was trying to go over when Representative, our Senator Devlin was going over the error rate and what we're doing, and the agency had come to me and talked to me about the policy package in relationship to what they want to do with some continued staffing. I hadn't looked at their staffing ratios or anything before. I guess I'm somewhat concerned that we have 24 principal executive managers on the staff and concerned about what the focus of what they do are in relationship to the rest of the staff. In addition to that, I mean, you have accountants and other kinds of professional IT people as well, plus 24 principal executive managers. It just seems like an excessive amount on first blush. Can we talk about how the rubber gets to the road on those?
Representative Butler, Chair Butler, Representative Patridge. Although at first blush, as you mentioned, that might look like a high level of persons who are working at a fairly high level within the state system, I think you can find some comfort in the fact that every single position in the agency was reviewed by the Human Resource Services Division in DAS. That was at the request of this body a budget note that came out of the last legislative session, and as a result of that, there were a number of positions that were shifted downward, a number of positions that were shifted upward. There was realignment of position classification internally. We actually just completed that process with the agency, and I think Dale helped me out. There were 60 some positions that that moved across the entire agency.
Yeah.
I think there's some comfort that every single position has had a desk audit and specifically been classed within the functions that they are actually performing.
Or the current staff management staff ratio is 1-7. It was larger than that previously. Is that right?
I would have to get back to you on that, Representative Butler.
Representative Patridge, follow up.
I guess that assumes that you believe in the state's classification system. That's a whole separate issue to...
That would be a larger
that's a whole
issue,
separate
Patridge.
Issue to deal with in terms of the state's classification system. I would be interested. I don't know how soon. I mean, our report showed them from 2018 is the...
Right.
Is our report... Is this current?
It's current in the sense of when the budget was put together. Now, the reclass package that was put in largely within the same dollars did the shifting. So you will see a number of those specific positions that have changed by the time we true up. There wasn't a significant cost savings overall after. Basically, the actions pretty much canceled each other out across the whole agency. But every position that was touched, those, again, I'm saying 60-some, I think it's within that range, will have a slight change from the initial run there.
Do they have a comparison or a... I mean, I'd like to see what the HR audit looked like, and maybe I'd like to drill down a little bit into that. The classification system.
Those reports I mentioned, I can give copies to the committee if you'd like. It's a short report, 4 pages. But I'll be happy to make that, get that for you.
Chair Boulder, Representative Pallage, could I offer two other comments about that? Because I think it is an important question, and in fact, it is my feeling that over the next 4 or 5 years, if the agency rights its ship, that ratio is actually going to go up. And let me explain why. There are two basic reasons. One is increased use of outsourcing. We are substantially increasing our use of outsourcing programming activities. And so what you see, for example, and I'll give you an example in this budget, is the creation of a new management position to run the project management office. It raises our ratio of management staff to internal staff, but the fact is that all the people that they're actually managing are outside. Another example is our healthcare subsidy program, where we have a manager, and they manage one internal staffer, but they manage an entire outsourcing contract that actually has many dozens of people. So it raises our ratio, and the more we use effective outsourcing, the higher the ratio is going to be of managers to our internal staff, but it's not going to tell you the true story of what our managers are doing. The second reason is that if we are successful in improving our technology over the next 5 years, we'll have more higher qualified supervisory people, and our automated processes will actually take the place of some of the staffers that we're here asking you for permission to hire today. So our ratio will go up, and I think it will be a sign of better, more economical management, not worse. The last thing I'd say is that according to page 43, our ratio of from the 0103 is actually for the 0103 budget versus the 0305 budget is actually going down about 1%.
Which 43 is it?
Yeah. It's page 43 of the agency overview. If you look at the legislatively approved on budget for 0103, we had an administrative position to program position ratio of 14.38%. That's actually going to drop down in the governor's recommended budget to 13.39.
So you're looking at, Jim? This is on the page 43, administrative agency overview.
Agency overview, page 43.
Great.
And I guess I want to say one other thing. When we have surges, as we have right now, we actually send our own personal secretaries and assistants out to do transactions. For example, last Friday, when we had a huge surge of retirees show up, all of our assistants were out on the front lines, on tables, out in front of the building, notarizing forms, taking, setting up people for interviews, and in fact, I was there myself. So, I think this only tells part of the story. It's really how effectively you manage on the ground that tells whether or not you're managing economically or not.
In that regard, Director Voitko, that some of the concerns are that you do have this rather enormous glut of folks that are coming through. They are, in fact, asking for retirement information as opposed to just getting an update on their accounts.
Chair Butler, that was true about a year ago. The mix has changed now. We're getting absolute applications, and in fact, we are just under 5,000 formal applications for retirement, not information. They've scheduled a date, submitted their papers, and that's just for the first 6 months of this year. We are normally staffed, and I think this is something we've worked out with DAS and Outflow, to do about 4,000 retirements a year. So the first half of this year, we have more than a year's worth of work to do.
Let's see, total current contributing participants amount, I think I talked to Steve yesterday, and they were 140,000, is that right?
Active employees, Chair Butler?
Active employees.
It's about 197,000.
197,000.
Of which about 40,000 are eligible to retire right at the moment.
Right, okay. One of the concerns that I've got is the majority of that 197 probably have almost no handwork that's necessary on an annual basis, do they, Jim? It's really just posting to the account the contributions of that existing participant and the employer, that is, and then making a calculation of just the interest on that account.
Chair Butler, you're exactly right that of our 300,000 members, there are a subset in the retiree group as well as in the active group that are relatively low maintenance compared to others. However, we happen to be in a demographic era where the average age of our employee, and I believe we have a chart here that shows the average age of our member, and it's around 50-some years old. For those of us who are 50 or so, this is the demographic chart of this would be page 27. In the agency overview, members of the committee, if you look at where the bulge is, where the sweet spot is in terms of our members' age, you can see that it's around 50. And those spring chickens in the room probably don't realize it, but when guys like me hit 50, we start thinking about retirement. I'm not ready to retire. That's not a pre-announcement. But the fact of the matter is we start talking to our HR people and to our retirement system, and we have fewer quiet people these days, even aside from the policy uncertainty, than we would normally have. So we have a relatively high amount of interaction with most members, but you're right, not all.
Okay. Further questions in that regard? Okay, now, Jim, you'll be taking us through the agency presentation or agency overview. Is that correct?
I would be happy to, Chair. I'd work at your discretion.
Okay, let's see. We have program discussion, retirement programs, and agency statistics, and then agency overview. Where would you like to start there, Jim?
I think agency overview would be probably the best place to go and to work down from there into details.
Okay. Now, we have handout here at the dais, Public Employee Retirement System 2001-03 Budget Note Response, Position Allocation Review, relative to the questions that we were given. Each one of us have a copy of that. So if you have questions on that, we may come back to that. So why don't you go ahead and start in on agency overview.
I'd be happy to do so, Chair Butler. The first page, which is page 2, really talks about why we exist in the first place. In many respects, we're very much like an entitlement program, but kind of a super entitlement program in the sense that the courts have looked at the PERS law, and Chair Butler, from your service on the PERS Substantive Committee, I think you have probably heard an earful about this, that the state or public employers generally have a contract not just with employees generally, but with each individual member and their individual circumstances. And so part of our mission is to try to execute what is one of the firmest statutory requirements and that is the execution of this obligation down at the individual member level. And that has implications programmatically, because it means that we have to keep individual employee records, at each employer that they work with over time. And so our mission in many respects is to execute this law, and it turns us into a giant record-keeping machine, if you will, that has both a data side, a document side, and a financial side.
And Jim, I was interested in a comment that you made earlier, disputes as to whether or not the employee was actually at some particular employer during some period. You're charged with somehow sorting that out?
That's exactly right, Chair Butler, because the law says that we're supposed to pay the pension obligation that has been accumulated. And employers and employees don't always agree on exactly what's been accumulated over time. But most of the time it's because of the data record discrepancies. When a person retires, say after 30 years, the records that are necessary to execute that obligation date back as many as 30 years. And that's why I say that we have a financial side, a data side, and a document side, because in the end, the documents from 30 years ago are the deciding sort of authority as to whether or not a person worked. And so that's what turns us into this giant record-keeping machine. So really, that's the story on page 3, accurate and timely record-keeping of all pension accounts for members over their careers and for employers in perpetuity. I think we've talked about that in the substantive committee as well, that this is that a pension system is not something that starts up and starts down. Our obligations to a member may date from the time they come into public service until the time their last beneficiary or survivor dies. It could be as long as 70 years. The other thing is that the financial side of that, again, I'm still on page 3, is that we have to try to look at all of the obligations that are being created and then try to figure out not only what's due each and every public employee, both active and retired, but also who to charge for it. And it is unusual for a public employee to work for the same public employer for their entire career. It's not out of the question. There are plenty of employees that do that, but it is far more common for people to switch jobs at least once, which means that we have multiple sets of records in order to make sure that the right taxpayers in the right political jurisdictions pay for the obligation that has been created during that time. We also have a relatively complex, and I'm probably speaking diplomatically here, pension program, with multiple tiers, multiple types of accounts, and so that the record-keeping obligation is I think, admittedly, both by third parties and by most of the people who have looked into our program, more than the average level of complexity in record-keeping. It's not at all like keeping, a checking account at a bank, for example. So I don't want to dwell on this too much, because I know particularly, Chair Butler, you've heard a great deal about the substantive side. If Senator Devlin has questions about that, that's fine. But if not, I'll conclude this section by saying that we don't engage in any activities that aren't in direct support of some statutory obligation we have. The clearest connection is the statute says we have to do a certain transaction by a certain date. The next level is record keeping, which the statute doesn't exactly tell us how to keep the records, but we have to reach out and do the things necessary to get the data, to do the transaction that is required by statute. There are no programs that we've made from whole cloth that don't connect to some one of the 150 directives that are in the PERS statute.
Senator Devlin is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think a good example of that was I asked your staff yesterday. They were talking about the additional staff requirements and processing requests, for retirement. And the question came up, well, I remember that back in PERS history, there, prior to your tenure, maybe even prior to your, there were problems with members actually retiring and being able to get their benefit checks in a timely period. In fact, I think there were some people that were waiting up to a year to get their first check. And I asked, well, if we are short of staff, is there any problem with not delaying that long, but delaying? And they said, yes, the legislature, after that problem probably occurred, passed a statute that gave you, I think, what, 61 days to cut the first check. So, I mean, I think many of those things in terms of timeliness have, you're absolutely right, we've placed those timeliness requirements on members.
Chair Butler, that and Representative Devlin, that is exactly right. There are times when we also want to complete the transaction. In the transaction business, there's a phrase called one and done. And that is that if we come to the point where because of mismatch of workload and our ability to do the transactions that we do an estimated payment, which we do reasonably often during periods of stress, it means that we have doubled our workload for that member because we have to come back and recalculate it. In the transaction business, one and done means if you can get it done right the first time, there's a huge productivity benefit because you've put that one to bed. Anytime you have to do an estimate, it's an admission of defeat in the productivity game. So we try hard not to do that. But we also try hard not to, again, make up things that don't contribute to one and done.
Further questions? Please proceed, Jim.
All right. Page 6 talks about
Colleagues, we're in the agency overview. We're on page 6.
Page 6 talks about, Chair Butler, how we try to keep track of how well we're doing, or sometimes how poorly we're doing. We're extraordinarily frank about our shortcomings, and we're very proud of how much we are able to do. But we use this says two methods. I want to stress that it's really three. One of them are the internal performance measures that we use that are reviewed in our weekly executive management meeting, and those are really at the level of the grass, the blades of grass. In many cases. An example that we discussed earlier is the backlog report. We have reviewed that in our management meeting many times, and we'd be happy to provide a copy of that as an example for what we do there. We also use performance measures that are generated and required of us by the state as a whole. But we go one step beyond that, and we find it extraordinarily useful in that we bring a third party in. I believe it's once a year. Is that correct, Dale? It's a group called Cost Effectiveness Measurement, and they are specialists in the pension management and investment business process cost analysis. They really blow everybody else away in terms of the level and the sophistication of their analysis of cost structure. And they've been extraordinarily helpful to us. So we use their analyses to help us get a sense of how well or how poorly we're doing in individual areas. And not only that, but what are the things when we have above average costs, what tends to be the factor that's driving that? If you look at the last three or four cost effectiveness reports, what you find is program complexity is by far the biggest driver of our administrative costs. Links to Oregon benchmarks. Because we're such a specialized agency, we have very few links to the general state benchmarks.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Winters is recognized.
First of all, I apologize for being late. As chair of another committee, I often have other meetings in the morning to try to wrap up. But I have a question. I'd like to go back to your performance measurement on page 6. And your customer satisfaction. When you do your surveys, who are the customers that you're sending your survey to?
Chair Butler, Senator Winters, we do a variety of different kinds. Let me give you two examples that I think will be responsive to your question. We just did one of the deferred compensation program, and I believe we did a sample size of about 600 participants across all of state agencies that have signed on to the deferred compensation program. And we've just reached our 100th local employer just the other day who has signed on to the Oregon Growth Savings Program. And we asked them a variety of questions. So that one was particularly participant-driven. We've also done a number of employers surveys, particularly with respect to our ability to connect with them in a technological fashion or service them with respect to their HR effort to help them help their employees, and it reduces our workload. We've also done large surveys. We did one about a year ago that was a very highly stratified sample that touched deliberately almost every single category of member, and we have many different flavors of members in terms of different rule sets and statuses within the system. And I believe that one was somewhere between 650 and 750 participants that participated. So it's quite a variety, Senator Winters. I hope that was responsive to your question.
I just was looking at your universe, whether it was how much of the employee and how much was the employer.
And I think the answer, Senator Winters, is some of each, but the questions are different. On page 8, we reference the fact that we are working with DAS on their performance measure review committee evaluation. And we actually, one of our objectives for the next biennium is to, particularly once the session is over and the legislative support activities go down somewhat, we hope to turn that particular resource toward a major revamping of our performance measures, both to help us comply as much as we can and maybe even more so with the state guidelines, but also improve our internal performance measurement system. I mentioned on page 9 our use of cost-effectiveness measurement survey. One of the things that I didn't mention when I discussed it earlier is that one of the most useful features is that they have a very large universe of pension systems that look like us, big, relatively complex, and so it really helps us see whether or not what we're doing is within the realm of reality given the performance of our large peer public pension systems in the United States. Page 10 and 11 are organization charts that give you a sense of the way we've tried to structure the agency. Let me talk just a little bit about, because it has changed a little bit since the last time we were before the committee.
Is that 40 positions in 01 or 03, 05?
These are 40. I'm sorry, Chair Butler, I'm not hitting the 4 the 40 is.
From 218 to 258.
Oh, yes. Right. I see. One of the things that we have tried to do is to build up our internal audit capability. That's really an 0103 step that we took, and the legislature was very supportive and gave us authority to hire and fund a director of internal audit that we never had before. So now you see that on page 11. You also see the policy planning and legislative analysis group. We anticipated that with the tremendous interest in pension policy and in our program, that the legislature was going to have multiple inquiries as well as stakeholders and do a top-to-bottom review of pension policy. Those positions, and I know you've seen Steve Delaney often, who heads that group, but underneath him are a small group of people that really, working with me and Steve, have produced all of the analyses that that the legislators have seen over the course of the last year. And I hope that those have been helpful to the legislature. They certainly have been helpful to us. The simulations, the replacement ratio studies, and all of the other studies and testimony that we've delivered. That's a change from the last budget review that we had. And in my view, it's been a change for the positive. Also in that group, we have lodged a legal liaison, which used to be done as a tertiary activity of one of our senior managers. And what it caused us to do was to lean more heavily on purchasable or Department of Justice activities and service that we really didn't necessarily need to do, but we had no capability of even thinking those things through internally. So that's been a major positive for us as well. The rest of the divisions, the Information Services Division, this is an area that I think has been acknowledged for several years as being too small and focused on old technology, insufficient capabilities to move the place forward in terms of building new tool sets. We have been methodically strengthening this area. In fact, we just hired a position that was authorized, a quality assurance director permanently, which will allow us to eventually let go a service quality assurance person. And again, this is an area that we are strengthening, and we're also using more outsourcing here to try to limit the number of programmers that we hire to control our FTE, and instead have more program managers to use to access outside resources if and when we need them, but not put them permanently on the payroll.
You have demonstrates here at 40305 the total of, if I count them, probably 62 on your information systems staff, administration, and technical support, and the other staff there. Are they truly information technology people, or are they people that use the information technology to get the water to the end of the row?
Chair Butler, that's an excellent question, and I would say that with respect to technical operations, about half of those people simply operate the pipeline.
Okay.
The other half actually design, change, control it. The software engineering, those people are true technical people.
You get software engineering and 15 more in re-engineering.
And those are people that are really our program management staff. Working with IRMD, we have recreated that group and created a project management office, which is the industry standard way of doing this in the private sector. And in fact, it's the process that DAS itself and IRMD has adopted. And what happens there, it says re-engineering, but these are people who are project leads. They're all Project Management Institute certified, and they are capable of working with a user and with either internal or outsourced resources to execute a project that they must own. And so when the senior management wants to know how a project is going, there is a person who gets called to the table, and they own that project. It's been one of the most positive changes that we've made. But in response to your question, I would bring your attention to the 10 people we have in image and information management. Those are not technology people. There's only one manager in there. The other 9 people are folks that microfilm documents. In fact, I believe they're our lowest paid employees in the entire building. It's a fairly routine clerical job, but it's very important to us because without those documents in our database, we can't process transactions. So if you look at those 10 positions, in direct answer to your question, those are not technology people. But they happen to be housed because they are running our document, they're operating our document management system, such as it is, in the Information Services Division.
That's within the facility at Tigard, is that correct?
That is correct.
And as we look at the 2001-2003 staff with a total of 218 positions, and then we take a look at the 03-05 proposed staff at 258 positions, do you actually have that many workstations?
Another excellent question, Chair Butler. The answer is no, not at the present time. But literally before I came down here, I got a report on some of the strategic actions that we're doing to try to accommodate these people without absorbing additional space if we possibly can. And one of those things is that we are converting some of our conference rooms and subdividing them into cubicles to try to increase workspaces. We actually have a potential proposal on the table to use our boardroom and subdivide it and put people in there so that we can not have to go outside for space. We are going to rent storage space and take every physical object that is not temperature sensitive and remove it from the building to squeeze in a few more. And we are also considering going to shifts so that we can utilize these people without going to extra space if we possibly can. We're prepared to do whatever we can under the union contract, and there are some limitations as to what the union contract that the state has agreed to will allow us to do with respect to shifts and other things. But we're prepared to do whatever we can do to make workstations for these people, because it makes no sense to say you need these bodies for the next 2 years and not have a place for them to work.
Okay.
If I could move to page 12 and talk a little bit about the customer services division. Your question earlier, Chair Butler, was very apropos as a lead-in to this question. The customer service division has often been looked at as the things that we do to be nice to members. And I suppose, given that we're a member-driven organization, that's not an unreasonable way to look at it. But we look at it the other way as well. We look at this as a productivity and accuracy enhancement issue. When I was working the lines myself, the retirement lines, last week on Friday, it was so clear that our program is complex enough that every member is concerned with making mistakes in the multiple forms that they have to submit to do a transaction, whether it's a refund, a purchase of credit time, a retirement. I mean, we don't just do retirements. We have actually a full palette of types of transactions we do for members. What we find is that every member inquiry that we can successfully address here is an error that we don't have to address when it comes time to do an actual transaction. So we think that the customer services division provides service to members, but it also improves the accuracy and productivity of the agency as a whole. There are some transaction capabilities that we have lodged here. One of them is the deferred compensation program itself is housed in this division, because we do keep it very separate. And I think Mr. Wayan knows that we go to some extraordinary lengths to keep it financially separate, to keep time logs, because it is a separate statutorily authorized program, and it needs to carry its own weight. I think Dallas referenced the audit that was done looking at the deferred compensation program during the 2001-03 biennium. The other transaction responsibility that customer service has is to do benefit estimates. And that is very much like a real transaction. It's kind of an early run-through. And so the people there are actually skilled in doing transactions, and we often borrow from this division when we have workload surges upstairs, or we have people out sick or on other types of leave. The processing and data quality division on page 13 is really the record-keeping machine part of our organization. There's two major parts of it. One is to build the record for 5 or 10 or 20 or 30 plus years for a member in preparation for transactions along the way, like refunds or repurchases of service time, as well as to prepare the record for a clean and smooth transaction when they move from one part of our system, the active membership, into the retiree portion of our system. This is an area where we need an enormous amount of work, and it is an area that we have some of our most substantial backlogs in, which I referenced earlier. The other part of the processing and data quality division is the two parts that do the actual transactions. And we've divided that into two groups. One we call retirement services section, and those are the people that do the routine. When I say routine, there's not much that's routine in PERS, but those that, for example, don't involve some special twist. So a normal general service or police and fire retirement would move through the retirement services transaction. Then we have another section, which we call special services, and they do ones that involve deaths, disabilities, and divorces. These are ones where, obviously, all I have to do is say those three words, And anybody who's who's familiar with estate planning or retirement planning knows that those introduce enormous complications. And the statutes are very clear in some respects and sometimes not quite so clear in terms of how we handle disabilities, how we handle divorces, and so on. And so this section basically siphons off the transactions that are highly labor-intensive. And most of these transactions, by the way, are not supported by our automated system. And therefore, for productivity reasons, we've decided to concentrate the special knowledge in dealing with divorce decrees, for example, or disabilities in a separate group from our retirement services transaction. The next section on page 14 is the fiscal services division.
Jim, before you jump onto that section, I just was... I'm stuck back here on 12 for just a moment. You've got a Salem office that shows up 10 positions. That's under the Customer Service Administration. What goes on here in Salem separate from your other operations?
Chair Butler, two particular programs are run out of the Salem office. One, there two of those 10 people are the entire staff for the health insurance subsidy program. You recall that PERS was given by the legislature a program and a trust fund to build that provides a $60 a month subsidy to contribute toward the health care premiums of PERS retirees who opt into the program. That is almost entirely outsourced except for these two employees and the occasional intervention of some of our financial staff at appropriate times. The other Salem activity is our deferred compensation program, which is the other eight, and they handle the 20,000 participants roughly in the deferred compensation program, and most of that, as Dallas will recall from the audit, is also outsourced. Most customer service for that is outsourced to our third-party administrator. All of the investment management is outsourced to our investment managers. So those are the two main activities that occur in the Salem office. In the past, we've also done work with PERS retirees or active members out of the Salem office. But since the last biennium at the direction of the legislature to reduce that activity, we pulled that back and concentrated it in Tigard because it's far more efficient.
Where were you at in Salem, or where are you at in Salem, and do you have any other off-campus sites?
Chair Butler, we don't have any other off-campus sites. We used to have a very small interim office that we manned in Eugene, but we eliminated that sometime a while back. Really, we're just a two-location outfit.
And rented space in Salem, is that what you have there?
We rent space. We don't have our own building. We rent it in the archives building in a piece of the upstairs. And we do have a few seats there as well that we might be able to fill with an answer to your workspace question because the space came as a block.
All right. Please.
Thank you. Let's see. Where are we? We are at the Fiscal Services Division. I'm pleased to have Dale Orr, our director of the Fiscal Services Division, with me today, and I want to thank him publicly for putting together our budget that we're presenting to you today. The Fiscal Services Division is really kind of the CFO's office of our organization. We have financial flows across our general ledger of multiple billions of dollars each year. Because we have approximately about $1 billion worth of contributions coming in and about $1.7 billion worth of payments going out. And so Dale's division is responsible for all of the financial reporting and accounting associated with those flows, kind of at the top of the accounting ladder, so to speak. Tax compliance, a more important issue as time goes on, as the tax code continues to change over time. All of the general fiscal services associated, for example, with the budget, with our payroll, with accounts receivable and payable, are all handled in the Fiscal Services Division. And in addition, they have their own trust fund that they administer. It's a very small one. but it's the Benefit Equalization Fund. It is the fund that we have to set up for paying benefits that are beyond the IRS qualification limit. Is that correct, Dale? And we don't have a lot of members in it, but also it's another one of those trust funds that all the work is done manually for that. In addition, fiscal services, we've also housed with them our building management and mail services responsibilities. The Information Services Division on page 15 is probably the division that, as I mentioned earlier, has undergone the most change. We have begun a process of increasing the professionalization of that area. We've tried to introduce people into that area with experience, not just in the old obsolete technology that we currently operate, but people capable of helping us move to more modern technology. We, in addition, as I mentioned earlier, a very key move was this move to a project management office structure. It has allowed us to, as senior management, to have much more sort of finger on the pulse of the multiple projects, large and small, that we have ongoing in this area and will probably have ongoing in this area for the next 5-plus years. In addition, they also operate our local area network, our telephone system, and our ability to communicate from a data point of view with the DAS mainframe here in Salem, which we rely on very heavily, as well as with archives and their record management responsibilities for the state. You recall, I believe we have a 175-year requirement in terms of the storage of documents, as well as with our 800-plus public employers whom we get data from. So their responsibilities are not limited to just running our own PCs or just operating the RIMS system, which is our retirement mainframe hardware system, but actually extend well beyond that. Page 16, I won't go into too much detail on this unless you would like me to. This is the group that we formed during the 2001-03 biennium, and I have to be extremely thankful to the legislature for supporting us in this. It, in fact, over time has accumulated additional responsibilities as we've tried to focus the transaction staff on transaction services exclusively for reasons of productivity and specialization. Let me give you an example. When we first proposed this and the legislature supported us, we talked about the management of contested cases, which is on page 16, our legislative relations and support activities, administrative rule development, and so on. We have moved into this new responsibilities like employer integration services because this is a transaction, it's a highly legal intensive transaction. A contract is actually written between a new employer and PERS, and what we have found is some of the complexity of our program has been inadvertently introduced by the use of non-standard or one-off kinds of contracts with employers over the last 20 or 30 years. And so by putting it in this area, we have controlled and standardized it so that when a new employer comes in now, they must come in under the same terms as every other employer. We have a no special deals policy because the legislature hasn't authorized us to do any special one-off types of transactions. And until you do, we believe that prudent and effective administration of the program is everybody comes in under the same terms. So this policy planning and legislative support group has proved, I think, very, very helpful in both supporting the activities of the legislature but also the administration of the system as a whole. Then we have three other areas that I talk about on page 17. The internal audit one I mentioned earlier. Again, this is another area where the legislature in 2001-03 allowed us to hire a much more senior person. In fact, we hired one of the most senior audit people from the Division of Audits to run the internal audit program. I can't tell you how successful that's been. I'm very, very pleased, and it makes me sleep easier at night with an audit staff now of two rather than one. the health insurance program has been relatively static, and not in the sense of growth, but in the sense of staffing. I don't think we've asked for any staff for this area, and I don't believe we have in some time. And it's partly because the outsourcing that we have used has been extremely effective. We've retained policy control and fiduciary control over this program, but without having to hire a substantial number of internal staff. As I said, we have two. So I'm very pleased at the stability of this program. The personnel department has not been as effective as I would like. We did a review of our own ability to hire effectively and quickly about a year ago, and we found out that we were slow we were not terribly pleased with the pools of candidates we were building. We have since hired a new human resources director, a very experienced one in both the public and the private sector. And this is an area that we believe continues to need some strengthening in order to try to build the agency into the future biennia. That is one area that I think is on our continue to work on list, as opposed to the other two, which I think are in very good shape right at the moment. Page 18, Dale wanted to make sure that we made the point that we do two things to, again, try to increase efficiency. We pool administrative support in many ways. For example, we have a small publications pool so that our transaction staff are not writing one-off template letters and instead focusing on transactions. And we have lower classified staff who can do the publications work that needs to be done in terms of contacting members. The other thing is that we try to be as careful as we can be, given the technology that we have, to keep costs separated by program. And we do this in two ways. One is that we try to separate costs according to the trust fund that's being supported, partly because that is required by fund accounting standards and it's required by the statute. But in addition, we work with cost effectiveness management that I worked earlier to try to report data that allows us to generate at least some good sense of what cost per transaction or cost per member served or cost per inquiry. And that is more of internal use. It's not required by statute that we do that, but it certainly helps the senior management try to fine-tune where we are misapplying our resources or where we're falling way short of what we think are administratively appropriate performance standards. Cora mentioned earlier in her summary that we have two major budgetary programs, as are noted on page 19, our retirement services and deferred compensation. What can I say about page 20? I suppose this one of the things that I would emphasize about the chart on page 20 is that this takes the same view of our agency, but instead of putting divisions in and staff and FTE and sort of who's responsible for management, it looks at us through programmatic function. And it says, let's sweep away the resources and instead look at the programs you're responsible for. And when you look at us that way, we really have our retirement programs and our deferred compensation program. Underneath our retirement programs, though, we have a multitude of different types of programs, and in fact this understates the different varieties and categories of membership categories we have. But we have Social Security, the Benefit Equalization Fund I mentioned earlier, the main PERS Pension Trust Fund. We also have Retirement and Disability, which works off the main PERS fund but is in statute a separate set of programs and rule sets. And then the health insurance program that we discussed earlier. We can go through this. This is something of a repeat of what Cora said. I mean, the message is very clear, and we don't want to underplay how important it is for us to operate administratively on the most effective and efficient level we can. But when it comes to either making big financial mistakes or generating financial pluses for the state of Oregon. The name of the game is on the non-limited funds. And I think, Chair Butler, you've sat through enough committee hearings in which we've talked about actuarial fiscals that have numbers on them that are so large they dwarf our entire budget many times over. And again, I don't say that to in any way imply that we shouldn't be extremely efficient, but I will tell you as director, if I have an opportunity to affect the actuarial side of our cost structure versus an FTE or two somewhere in the structure, my first responsibility, as I see it, is to try to acquire the actuarial savings for the state and its taxpayers through employer rates, because the numbers are staggering in terms of their size. I think it is useful to look at page 23, because one of the things that you get from the picture on page 23 is how diverse the set of activities are that our administrative budget and our FTE that are associated with it are faced against. We focus...
Yeah, can I just ask, sure. This was taken off of some sort of a work chart, I assume, that you went through and said these are the various functions we've got, and then you've allocated the actual employee time to that. Is that what's happened here?
That is exactly correct, Chair Butler. In fact, this is a classic example of what I said about the importance of the cost-effectiveness management activity that we engage in with this third party. This is the key pie chart that we generate to compare to other public pension agencies and to generate these per-cost estimates that we try to manage to.
In that process, our plan is so unique. In some instances, you wouldn't have folks spending any time on perhaps disability pensions or deferred compensation programs administration.
You're absolutely correct. Again, Representative Butler, for example, the state of Colorado does not have disability in its pension program, in its retirement program. It's a separate program that is run outside the pension program. And what that means is that if we were to compare ours to theirs, it would be apples to oranges, because they don't face off against that. What CEM does that's very interesting is that they actually have a detailed scorecard that tries to rate the complexity of each program and then adjust the costs with a consideration of the complexity. So if we ran a very simple program but had low costs, we might not look so good once they had adjusted for the fact that we have a fairly simple program. In our situation, our adjusted costs look much more favorable because we have way higher than the average amount of complexity. But the point that I draw from this, and I work with legislators and stakeholders on, is that if you look at this chart, it tells you to be very careful to focus too much on how many people are retiring. It is true that when somebody retires, it is one of our most time-intensive and time-sensitive transactions. But as you can see, it is just one of an entire sort of smorgasbord of transactions and activities that the pension system engages in for the state of Oregon. I think page 24 is a repeat. Maybe we could we could move to 25 and talk a little bit about that, although, I don't want to beat a dead horse here, because the themes that we have listed on page 25, I think we've had a good discussion about. There are two that I do want to talk about a little bit more, and that is the first bullet and the third bullet. The boom that we're experiencing right now in retirements is not a one-time phenomenon. It's probably going to be reflective of the circumstances that we'll face over the next 10 to 15 years because of that age wave distribution that you saw that I called your attention to earlier. That doesn't mean that we'll have the current situation for every single month from now for the next 10 to 15 years. It's going to wax and wane. But in general, we have a huge slug in the pipeline, if you will, of folks that will be exiting one half of our system, the active employment side, and entering the other half, the retiree side, both of which require service, financial activity, and transactions, but they're just different. The thing that I want to stress about the first bullet point is that we, when we did an analysis, we thought, gee, if we could just get past this bulge, even if it is 10 to 15 years long, it'll be clear sailing after that. Well, we didn't think that thing through very carefully, because unless there are substantial, and I mean very substantial, cutbacks in the total level of public employment in the state of Oregon, for every person that moves out of the active side into the retiree side, we anticipate that the public sector will add one plus something, because our historical record is that the public sector has grown moderately with the entire growth of the state of Oregon. So what that means is that if we retire these members, what we're doing at the same time is new active employees are entering the pension system. So our workload might plateau, but it's probably not ever going to go down.
Senator Winters?
No, I'm just listening.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Very attentively listening.
Okay.
The other thing I wanted to mention was the third bullet point, and I know you've heard a lot about how weak our information technology structure is. It is a great concern to me. We have something like 30 to 40 individual projects, large and small, underway to try to lengthen the lifespan of our existing technology system, and we have a couple projects underway to try to introduce some replacement technology. We're extraordinarily excited about those two. Our technology budget, the other point I wanted to mention about this, is not really in this budget. We have a separate sort of pathway that we have dealt with the legislature on with respect to, in essence, capital spending on our technology plant. And so you're not going to see much in here except for permanent strengthening of the IT staff is the extent of really the technology that you'll see here. We have about several million dollars that the legislature, the e-board, approved in a series of actions over the course of the last year that we are currently working on. And at the present time, we're not asking for any more because from a prudence point of view, we're only spending money as fast as we think we can generate and control projects and make sure that they're successful. But as a manager of a large record-keeping entity, I am not comfortable with the tools that we have to work with if we're to do our mission. We talked about the age wave chart on 27, I don't want to, again, beat a dead horse, but the topic that I introduced before, the fact that we may very well see a plateau about 15 years out, but probably not a decline, is illustrated on page 28. This is a projection that we made of what happens when you retire the baby boomers, but behind them the public sector makes replacement hires, and particularly tends to hire people at a higher average age than was true in the 70s and 80s. Our average entry age has crept up almost 10 years in terms of the people who are now coming in to the public sector. Interestingly enough, what that means is that rather than having them in our system for 20 years before they come to us for a retirement transaction, we might have them 10. And so that actually, on a transaction per person, the older a person is when they join PERS, as long as they stay 5 years, the faster they're going to move through our system and generate transactions. So that's why I made the point earlier that even when we get past the baby boomers, we're not out of the woods. And this is a chart that you'll see in every public pension plan in the United States and probably most private ones for corporations that have been in business for 30 or 40 years. Page 29, program complexity.
Question.
Yep.
Senator Winters.
Has there been an analysis of why individuals are entering into both the public and private sector at a later age?
Chair Patridge, Senator Winters, the answer is no. There's been speculation. One of the speculations is that we've had a compensation package that has, compared to the private sector, has been somewhat more weighted toward retirement. I mentioned earlier that when folks like me get to be 50, we start thinking about retirement. and we're more inclined, on average, to find a place that has a compensation package that meets our needs. The public sector's compensation package has been that kind of package. And I can say anecdotally, our own hires, whom I've asked that question of, more often than not have said that that's one of the reasons. Stability and the ability to vest either in another pension plan or get a or get into this pension plan if they haven't had a pension plan previously or have had one that they haven't amassed a significant benefit in.
So if I can kind of summarize, if you have good beanies, you don't think about your future until you become older when you want to retire. So the old notion that we used to prepare for retirement is no longer there, and the realization hits when you're in your middle age.
Chair Patridge, Senator Winters, I can't say that that's a global phenomenon, but I can say that I've read literally hundreds and hundreds of articles on financial planning in my prior life, and it is a mantra chanted by financial planners across the country that it would be wise if people thought more about retirement when they were 25 than when they were 45.
This is also true if we're talking about health care coverage.
Well, to defend my generation. I actually thought that there were more people who were younger who were looking at retirement plans now than ever before because of lifestyle change, actually, and because they wanted to retire earlier.
It could be your generation, Mr. Chair, your generation.
We are the I generation, most definitely.
And have you learned from the baby boomers?
We're always receptive to learning.
I'll talk to him later.
Well, Chair Patrick,
is that an appropriate answer? Go ahead, Jim.
Okay. Page 29, program complexity. One of the administrative challenges that we have and a cost driver that we have is that it has been the policy of the state over the last 57 years to build a program that has many different facets to it. And I say this not as a complaint because I'm a policy taker, not a policy maker. But I think anybody who has looked at our statute and looked at the graph that we've made of it and the multiple interventions, we have 150 plus now directives to the PERS board to take particular kinds of actions or authorizing particular kinds of actions. It has a consequence in terms of the administrative job that we have. But it is what it is. What's interesting is that as the legislature has come to grips and decided to make some changes in it, the additional changes that are being driven by the policy designs of the legislature are adding new sections to the statute, and it's kind of inevitable. Once you're in this situation, the more changes you make, the larger the statute gets, the more things we have to do. And so in the last, from 1999 onward to today, we've had 18 bills and 100 statutory modifications. Just in the special sessions and in the previous regular session, we've had multiple significant changes, like the lump sum option, the total lump sum option. We've had an entirely separate section of the statute added for earnings crediting that deals with particular kinds of payments made by employers. And we have additional ones. In fact, I believe it was released to go to the Senate floor yesterday, the actuarial equivalency factor update, which will be a major change in policy with very large challenges for us administratively. Again, I don't say this as a complaint. It is what it is, and we will execute the policy that the legislature sends down, but it would be imprudent for us not to recognize that it's it's quite all right.
House Bill 2004 had a referral to the Senate General Government and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, so it will be coming here before it goes to the Senate floor. And as we mentioned yesterday, that was for the reasons of tying down any change in employer rates so we can make adjustments to other agency budgets as well as address any budgetary needs of the public employees retirement system as a result of the changes to the actuarial equivalency factor.
But Jim, haven't you kind of set a
communicated at least to the legislature that we need to get
PERS the stuff by, we need to make whatever statutory changes we need to make by May 1 in order to
really allow you the proper time, and even that's a tight deadline, I wouldn't imagine.
Chair Patridge, that is exactly correct. If it's the desire of the legislature to have changes in place when rates are scheduled to go up on July 1st, there's an inevitable time that's necessary to recalculate rates for 860 different employers, and so May 1st or thereabouts is the deadline. It doesn't mean that we can't do it again later, but we'd hate to do it sequentially as we go along if we can avoid it. And that's what we've communicated is we'll do it any way the legislature tells us to, but if you want it to be in effect on July 1st,
you'd like to have it by May 1.
Exactly.
Okay.
And the chair asked us to sort of address those issues and the time frames that actually will require us to take some action now to meet those deadlines at the end of our presentation so as not to sort of complicate the presentation of the budget that we worked with BAM to develop over a year ago when we had no idea that these things would be coming to pass. I mentioned, I think, pretty much what I had to say about page 30 and the information technology base, except I want to stress that a record-keeping entity, its productivity is directly driven by its the strength of its technology base, because there are really only two ways to keep records. You can have lots of people at lots of desks filling in ledgers, or you can have sophisticated automated record-keeping machinery. There is no record-keeping entity in the state that I visited, and I visited the five largest other than ourselves, that hasn't moved heavily into the automated version because it requires far less staff. And it's far more accurate. Let's see. What I would like to do on page 32 in discussing the backlogs is we've just given you some examples here. I think here Representative Johnson is an answer to a question that you asked earlier that I only vaguely answered when I said thousands. We have 9,000 account adjustments that are backlogged, member notifications, and other types. What I'd like to do is provide the committee with the actual backlog report that we have, because I think it will be far more responsive to the representative's question than my off-the-cuff remarks. The one thing I did want to mention here about these adjustments is these, for audit reasons, are not easily made, and for technology reasons. We have something called a database fix. A database fix is very time-intensive for two reasons. One is it's a manual fix. You have to go in and correct a contribution level that was made in 1999 by an employer on behalf of an employee that now affects their year 2002 account statement and therefore the benefit that they believe they have earned through that date. We cannot allow people to go into the database unshepherded and start making these changes. So it's kind of like, I don't know if you're familiar with missile silos for nuclear weapons. Two operators, two keys, and no one person can reach far enough to do the two keys. Well, it's labor-intensive in that sense that we cannot allow people access to the database that would generate financial obligations without supervision. The second thing is...
Senator Winters.
Always when I hear the word can't, I want to know why.
Because it would represent, Senator Winters, unacceptable audit risk. If we allowed people to make these changes by themselves, we would be opening the door toward them increasing the benefits of their friends and neighbors themselves. There's no financial institution I know that would ever permit it. But when you couple that with the fact that we have to make these manually, it makes them very labor-intensive. And so this backlog is one of the reasons that I'm so concerned about this backlog is that some subset of those requires exactly that kind of interaction. And it's not an audit risk that I feel is prudent to take on. We talked a little bit on page 33 about the accuracy issue. This just represents the tip of the iceberg in terms of the times we have to do an estimate or a transaction twice. There are really three times that that happens. One is, as I said before, we find an error, like in an audit, and we have to fix it. Because by law, we're not allowed to say, well, you know, it'll even out somewhere else. The second one is that a member can actually make us redo a transaction. For example, under the statute, the member can say, I chose option one, but I've changed my mind now. I really want option 2A. And so we have to go back and redo his retirement calculation or her retirement calculation and produce it under a different optional form. That's a right that they have by statute. The third thing is that we get in over the transom in our periodic reconciliations with employers data that's new and different than what we based the transaction on. Then we have to reconcile who's right, the employer who reported this or what the data that we had at the time we did the transaction. And then it can be redone again. And so we end up, even in the normal course of events, without finding errors, redoing about 15% of all of our retirement transactions because the member wants to change options or we find that the employer popped up additional data that they didn't have at the time of the transaction. So this brings us to page 34, which is what do we do about all this? And we sat down in a senior management retreat, which we held was off campus, but I can tell you it was.
Can I ask a follow up question, please? Back to page 33. Do you have any longitudinal information on your audit, financial audit? What's been the history? If I look at 02, if I look at 2000, if I look at 99, tell me, give me some information over a period of time. Has that stayed constant? Has it gone up and down? What's occurred?
Chair Patridge, Senator Winters, that's an excellent question, and the answer is we don't have very good longitudinal data. There are two reasons for that. One is this particular audit was very expansive because we asked it to be unusually expansive. So it doesn't really compare very well to anything else that's been done. Although the findings are consistent with the smaller samples that were drawn earlier. And so there is some longitudinal evidence there. And we anticipate that if we receive approval to do the accuracy initiative in this biennium, that we will once again ask the audits division to do a similarly expansive audit to do a longitudinal comparison before and after. And in fact, we're starting a whole new cycle. I just signed a letter last week to the audits division asking them to do this type of audit, again, asking them to expand it to twice the size. I've agreed to pay for it. These are expensive. They're $50,000, $60,000 a piece. We pay the audits division to do these. And I've asked them to start a new cycle in a different area of the agency so that we can be doing longitudinal before and afters every couple of years in more than just the benefits calc area. We've chosen a different area in this case. I believe it's a certain area of employer reporting that also has financial consequences if it's wrong. So as long as I'm in this seat, I would like to have a rolling set of these longitudinal before and afters to see if we're making progress in getting ourselves out of this hole.
Jim, just as an aside, since this committee does have the Secretary of State's budget as well, and based upon your experience in terms of not here but elsewhere as well as your experience here, is the Secretary of State's audit division really set up to give you the information that you need with the qualified expertise, or would you find it helpful to be able to use outside auditors to be able to bring in additional data?
Chair Patridge, based on my experience and my experience with before I came here in the private sector, in the federal government, as well as the experience I've had thus far with the Secretary of State's audit, I think that I would divide our audit needs into three areas. The first area is what I would call trust and verification of the general state of affairs. The Secretary of State's office does a good job in that, and particularly because they are a public entity, this is an imprimatur that's very important to us. I mean, we run the largest trust fund by a wide margin in the state, and for the Secretary of State, as they have consistently, to give us a clean set of general books, I think is a value to our members, to our employers, and to the taxpayers. They do that very well. There's another level that they don't do so well, and that is at the operational detail level. Because when they do an audit, they arrive, they do the audit, they write it up, and they leave. And that's not unreasonable. That's how they are supposed to operate. It's quite different than the way we use our own internal audit staff. We working with the internal audit director of audit, set a target. We go through the same process, but the internal auditor doesn't leave. He stays with that management group, whatever the area is, and stays through them and works with them almost in a management consulting capacity to figure out what we can cost effectively do to lower audit risk. That's quite different, and the audit division is not set up to do that. The third area where it's problematic is where there are special kinds of expertise that's necessary. And it's been our experience that the audits division has not shown the same kind of expertise in technology and technology processing that are available through, for example, DAS has made available the Gartner Group, a very well-known national group, and we've also worked with groups called DocuLabs, for example. Those people have come in, and we actually asked them to audit our technology choices or our options, and that work, quite frankly, is far superior to what we've seen from the Secretary of State's audit. And I don't mean to criticize them. You can't be good at everything.
No, that's there are certain limitations.
If I had my choice of spending $20,000 of trust fund money to do an audit of a technology choice I had to make, the Secretary of State's audits division would be quite low on the list in terms of the other options that we found and DAS has made available to us.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah,
ask it.
Yeah, please.
Mr. Boyko. Jim. You talked about your use of internal audits. Now, have you thought about, or we haven't talked about this yet, but from a budgetary standpoint, the bang for the buck for the use of maybe expanding the internal audit staff vis-a-vis contracting with a group that may not have the level of expertise you may be able to develop in, with your own internal audit staff?
Chair Patridge, Mr. Wyant, I think that we're working in that direction, and I can't tell you how pleased I was. Let's be frank. At the time I joined, there was a technology audit going on run by the audits division that to say I disagreed with its conduct and its conclusions is understating the question. However, since that time, the audits division, and I think the benefits calc audit, shows exactly how good and productive the working relationship can be. And they ran the show, and they came up with the conclusions. They made all the decisions, but the fact is it was a useful piece of work, and it was done in a very cooperative manner. Would I like to have more internal audit staff? Yes, because we have an audit list that extends to almost 100 items. And we, as a senior management team, work with the director of audit and our board, and we pick a couple each year. But I am very pleased at how the working relationship with the audits division has developed, and we've moved away from the areas, or they've moved away from the areas where their value added was small, and they have, working with us, focused on the things that they've done pretty well. So we're pretty happy with the direction things are going. I'm interested in what they would have to say about it. They were nice enough, though, to invite me to speak to their entire staff about these issues, and I said the same thing to them that I'm saying to you. And so I think that I think things are going in the right direction.
All right.
Senator Devlin.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Going back to your presentation in terms of listing, some of these things that you believe have to be addressed, these backlogs, just a question out of curiosity, actually. A lot of the numbers that are being displayed in terms of graphs and things are for active members. Does your large inactive
membership create any specific challenges for your staff in terms of, I'm just trying to think, you've got almost as many inactive members as you have active members.
Chair Patrick, Senator Devlin, that's an excellent question, and we have two kinds of inactive members. One are inactive vested, and they vary. Some of them are very interested in keeping up to date on the benefit that they've earned and vested in, but their interest waxes and wanes. But nonetheless, we have to continue to keep their records. And in fact, in contrast to more simple service-generated pension plans, see, we are a financial plan because of Money Match. It means that their benefit is actually growing and has to be tended to, even though they no longer work in the public sector. That's different than a full formula kind of plan where if they've completed their service, then our record keeping almost goes into hiatus for a while. It does not under Money Match. In fact, it compounds each and every year. Then we have the second category of inactive member, which is inactive non-vested. And we have to, by statute, we have to, for 5 years, we have to continue as if they were potentially to return to the system. That means that their account balances grow under Money Match. We have to credit earnings to them. We have to keep their records current. But after 5 years, if we don't hear from them and we can't find them, they fall into loss of membership status. And at that point, they don't cause us any problems, but they probably ought to, because we need to be looking for them if we're to fulfill our obligation to them, because we owe them their accumulated contributions if they should ever come to call. We have not done very much there. We have done some relatively inexpensive searches through Social Security and using IRS records where we're permitted to do so. But that group of people doesn't cause us much workload.
Mr. Chairman, follow up. For the inactive members that are vested, do we continue to track their addresses? And I mean, we send out do you still send out a yearly notice of what their benefits package or what their earnings are?
That is correct, Senator Devlin. We do send it out just like for every other member that has vested obligation from us. And we have not, as one of the backlogs is, we have not been able to keep addresses current because our members, both retired and inactive, move out of state, move even out of the country. And so we have a large stack of returned mail that has been set aside to research. It's part of it's one of the newest parts of our backlog to focus our staff instead on the transactions of live active members that are actually rolling through our system.
Final follow-up. For inactive members that are Tier 1, do they still have the 8% guarantee while they're inactive?
Chair Patridge, Senator Devlin, the answer is yes.
Then this may be a small number, but you do have to, at a point, retire people, right? I mean, because at a certain point, they would be mandatory retirement age. You'd have to locate them, retire them, and stop the accrual to their account. Is that...
Chair Patridge, Senator Devlin, I don't believe that that's true under statute. Nobody is forced to file to receive a retirement benefit.
We don't have a mandatory retirement age.
But a mandatory retirement would be the employer says you have to leave this job. That still is something short of you have to leave this job and you have to go to PERS and apply to get the benefit that's owed you. So nobody is obligated to show up at our door and demand their retirement benefit. Now, you know, it would seem nonsensical that anybody would not want to do that, but they're not required to. However, there is a penalty if at some point they don't. If they haven't begun to receive a benefit that has been accruing for them free of federal taxation by age 70 and a half, they start to run afoul of the minimum distribution rules. And so it's not to their benefit to wait beyond that point, even though that's well past the normal retirement age is set in statute on state statute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Winters.
Chair, want to go back to the page 32 in the backlog issue of the over 9,000 account adjustments. Do you have approximately a time element on each account that it takes to get it entered in? Because I'm trying to look at it on a broad basis of just what we're talking about when we say 9,000 account adjustments. If I did on a time on task analysis, how much time would it take me to actually get one account into the system and to where you're beginning to whittle down the 9,000 number? How many man hours?
Chair Patridge, Senator Winters, we don't have an average number, but the analysis I'm about to give you in short form will make you nervous in terms of how much effort. Let's take the Young case. I think you all recall the Young case, where it's a classic example of 2,000 members had their payroll readjusted for the late 1990s, I believe it was, which means they had to have their contributions readjusted. So in that case, we had to reach out to the employer. I'm starting from step one. The member had to say to us and to the employer, we actually worked this much overtime under the rules of the settlement of the Young case. Then the employer had to verify it and report it to us. Then we had to take it and go back to 1999 and rewrite financial compounding history. That is, if we had to redo their accounts as if they had put in money at that time and it had actually been earning money through the subsequent years, meaning all of their subsequent account balances changed. It's the same as if you had a bank savings account and you said to the bank, I know I put an extra $100 in 3 years ago. And so you've got to go back and rewrite financial history. Then all of those, and we have to verify all those with the employer, and then we have to do what I mentioned earlier, and that is we have the two missile keys. We have to set a computer programmer and a supervisor in place to go into our database and make that change for that one person, make all the series of changes that are required to adjust for those historical that change in history, and bring it up to date, and then walk away. And I can tell you that that's a long time. Just the programming part alone is sometimes as much as 8 hours.
Jim, I understand that the 2000 on the Young case was a special situation that occurred that required a lot more time and effort. I guess what I'm getting at, you have of this 9,000, is the Young case still in that 9,000?
A small subset is about 250 or 300 of the Young case.
Then if I follow up, if I remove out the Young case and that subset, on average, what are some of the other problems that you're dealing with this 9,000 backlog? I'm just trying to get my arms around some analysis of seeing how much time does it take in order to resolve some of it, rather than continue to say we've got this huge problem of 9,000 out there and oh my God, it's huge and big, but I can't tell you how much time it takes to resolve one.
Did you have something to add to that, Richard?
Yeah.
Senator Devlin.
An example I talked to your staff about was a constituent case that I had for a party that is not retired yet. But this may be an example where a recalculation, or presuming that it wasn't done as in the initial calculation, is she has 3 or 4 years of service as a substitute teacher where she was over the number of hours where she should have gotten PERS credit for those years of service but did not. So you'd have to, in that situation, you'd have to go back to the employer, verify that she actually worked those hours. There would have to be some agreement. I guess in this case, she would have to pay the employer's original contribution if it had not been paid. The employer would have to pay the contribution, plus probably the employer would have to pay the earnings from the date of the contribution. And this particular case goes back to the mid-1980s. It might be a fairly significant detailed calculation, but simply by an error of not actually depositing funds for an employer in a case where at least allegedly they should have been deposited.
But I think Senator Winters, I think Senator Winters' issue is that, well, there's still got to be an average amount of time. I mean, the cases may be different. I mean, we're comparing apples and oranges and pears, but there's still an amount of time.
There's still an amount. I'm not talking about those cases that do come up, not the 2,000 that had to do with the Young case. But at some point, I would think, from an administrative standpoint, a management standpoint, you have some idea of what it's going to take in order to resolve this 9,000 backlogs of cases.
Mr. Chair,
that's where I'm trying to go.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, if I can try and answer maybe a different way. PERS actually does have a calculation internally where they try and do an average, and if you'll take a look at, or you have to look at it right now, but policy package 103, which is the workload backlog clearance package. There are actually 11 limited duration positions that are included in that package in the governor's balanced budget. And the intent of that package in those 11 limited duration positions is to clear this 9,000 transaction backlog. So their analysis basically has said to clear that 9,000 in this two-year period, we get to 11 limited duration positions to do it.
I guess from a policymaker, when you can't tell me how much time, when you can't tell me the universe, I struggle with saying that it's valid that I would approve 11 positions, and I'm just trying to.
Why don't we do this tomorrow? Why don't we start off because I know people have got to get to other meetings too. Why don't we start off right there tomorrow in terms of what the internal time looks like, what the backlog caseload growth is projected to be with this policy option package, and do you get to zero or do you maintain a backlog caseload of 2,000 and how the staff is going? Is that what you were getting at, Sarah? Why don't we begin with that tomorrow? It's a little bit after 10:30 now, so we'll go ahead and recess the committee to hold it over for tomorrow. And so if everyone's okay with that, is there anything else that we need to start off with tomorrow? And then we'll let Jim continue through his presentation tomorrow as well. So at this point in time, I'm going to continue until tomorrow. I'll just continue until tomorrow, the public hearing on Senate Bill 5538. So we're continuing that hearing. Over. Hearing no objection. So ordered. And at this point in time, we're going to recess the committee. Thank you.